pleasure here to be here at St. John's. Title of my talk is The Founder of American Founding. Americans regularly speak today of our founding and our founders. Our founders are everywhere. They're honored on monuments, large and small, and commemorated by the names of countless schools and streets, none more iconic than Madison Avenue. This focus on founding is rare in the world today. There was, of course, a founder of the Soviet Union, Lenin, Fascist Italy, Mussolini, and National Socialist Germany, Hitler, but these regimes are no more. Ataturk, hailed once as the great founder of modern Turkey, has largely been erased by everyone, and Mao Zedong is just barely hanging on in China. In the democracies, there's still a place for Gandhi in India, Mandela in South Africa, and perhaps Havel in the Czech Republic and De Gaulle in France. But the other European countries, like Britain or Netherlands, have grown into their current condition without having a founder.
With its attention to being founded, America today is more the exception than the rule. Unlike most other states, America has made founding a central theme of its political science. Yet, Americans are remarkably imprecise when it comes to assigning the label of founder. To whom should it apply? For most, the founder refers to an important political figure who helped the nation get started. At an Independence Day celebration on July 4th, between enjoying grilled hot dogs and viewing fireworks, Thomas Jefferson is almost sure to be mentioned. But no one would take exception if George Washington, James Madison, or Alexander Hamilton were added to the list. These men, and others too, are variously considered founders, having played a role in helping establish a new political order. But let's try for a little more precision than the average American has in mind. Founding can refer to three key moments in the establishment of the nation: the Revolution, the writing and ratification of the Constitution, and the launching of the government and passage of the Bill of Rights. The founding period thus runs from the Battle of Lexington in 1775 through the end of Washington's first term in 1793. Those who merit the appellation of founders include our revolutionary leaders, Franklin, Adams, Jefferson, and Washington, the principal figures who prepared and defended the Constitution, Madison, Washington, and Hamilton, and the political actors who shaped the new federal government in its critical first years, Washington, Hamilton, and Madison. If someone demanded to know which one of these three moments should be designated the founding, most historians, I suppose, would probably give the prize to the constitutional period of 1787 and 1788. At the center of this event was James Madison, the person subsequently labeled the father of the Constitution. Madison was essential in promoting the formation of a new government and in defining the terms of debate in Philadelphia. Along with Hamilton, he was the main author of the Federalists, which explained and defended the Constitution during the ratification contest. Feeling duty bound by an implicit agreement reached in many states during the ratification debate, Madison was the chief force in Congress in 1790 and 1791 in pushing for the Bill of Rights. James Madison is the subject of the talk this evening, but less for serving as a principal founder than for introducing the conception of founding or lawgiving itself into American thought. Before there could be a founding, there had to be an idea of founding. That idea had to become part of our way of thinking. Madison provided this intellectual breakthrough. He is the founder in America of the idea of founding. Now, this fact goes unrecognized today, as no one thinks that the idea of founding ever needed to be established. Founding is taken for granted and regarded as perfectly natural. We speak of the founding and the founders for the reason, we believe, that we had a founding and founders. But was this connection regularly made in 1787? Did Americans associate what was being done at that time with the instances of founding or lawmaking that had been accomplished in antiquity by, say, Moses in the desert of Sinai, Lycurgus in ancient Sparta, or Solon in Athens? Does the language of founding and lawmaking fit so readily with these classical examples as we suppose today? The truth, I believe, is that this terminology of founding was rarely employed in America before 1787. Almost no one, for example, used the language of founders or lawmakers to designate those who wrote America's first national constitution, the Articles of Confederation. Was John Dickinson, the James Madison of the Articles, ever honored as a founder? John Adams may have seen himself in this light when he wrote the Constitution of Massachusetts in 1780, but no one else, with the possible exception of Abigail, saw him in this way. The idea of a founding, far from being self-evident to all, had to be revived and promoted in 1787 and 1788. Reintroducing this language belongs to the authors of the Federalists, and above all to James Madison. It was Madison who took up the theme of the lawgiver and began comparing America's Constitution writers to the seminal lawgivers of antiquity. His purpose was to have Americans view the events unfolding before them through the lens of the idea of lawmaking, with its connotations of extraordinary action and bold remaking. Madison refined the idea of founding and suggested audaciously that our founders might rival and even replace the foundings of the ancient world. With this step, those we all call our founders today might not be known as founders at all. Now, founding or lawmaking was one of the fundamental themes of classical political science. Lawmaking was understood as the effort of an individual to bring into being good government, or at any rate, the best government possible under a given set of circumstances. Two elements were involved in the act of founding. First, there was the acquisition of knowledge of what promoted good government. In the case of the founding of Sparta, as described by the Roman historian Plutarch, the great founder Lycurgus made an extensive voyage around the Aegean before undertaking his task, examining different forms of government and considering which might be best for his native land. In Crete, he encountered the philosopher Thales, who had begun to elaborate a science of politics that studied the best regime and good regimes and how they could be established. The person who develops this knowledge of regimes, and Aristotle might be the most illustrious example, may be thought of as a teacher of lawgivers, or if you will, a proto or invisible founder. He gives advice to the actual founder. Second, there's the action of executing founding, which is the task of the founder, properly speaking. Perhaps this person has availed himself of a body of knowledge, as Lycurgus did by consulting Thales, or perhaps he founds without such knowledge, proceeding by his own wits and doing the best he can. In any case, as the teacher or proto-founder surely recognize, founding is only partly capable of being mapped out in advance by theoretical knowledge. Knowledge serves only as a partial guide for action. Given the importance of particular circumstances and actual situations, the facts on the ground will dictate different strategies. A founder must take account of what can be achieved by way of promoting a good regime and at what risks and costs. Gauging the situation they face, some lawgivers decide to settle for much less than they might have wished for. According to Madison and the Federalists, the Athenian founder Solon confessed that he had, I quote, not given his countrymen the government best suited to their happiness, but most tolerable to their prejudices. On the other hand, Madison remarks, Lycurgus remained more true to his object, which led him to take chances and to use violence, I quote, and the authority of superstition to accomplish his objectives. Lycurgus founded Sparta by resorting to what Madison called extraordinary measures. These measures of force were at odds with the principles on which he based the Spartan political system. It set up not just the difference between the founding and the political system, but a potential tension which the act of founding had established. Niccolo Machiavelli reformulated the classic account of founding, giving the subject his own special points of emphasis. Machiavelli brought the motives of the founder into question, asking how the task of founding might fulfill a founder's own interests. No longer did he assume that founders acted automatically to do the good for their compatriots without achieving something for themselves. The founders' goals had to be squared with promoting the public good. In line with the ancients, Machiavelli set out two general dimensions of founding. First, founding was aided by theoretical knowledge that he called the rules for the government of princes. Machiavelli offered his own political science as the best source of instruction, insisting that it was superior to the classics because it was more realistic. It took its bearings from how one lives rather than how one should live. The one who possesses this knowledge, though he does not literally act, is the proto or invisible founder. That was Machiavelli himself. Second, there is the actor who engages in the actual activity of founding. Machiavelli describes this individual in The Prince as one who makes his way by the use of his own arms and ability. The greatest, he says, are Moses, Cyrus, Romulus, Theseus, and their like, figures who took the lead in the introduction of a new order of things. In the Discourses on Livy, Machiavelli discusses these leaders under the name of founders, fondatori, and specifies their attributes and behavior. A defining feature of a founder is that he is almost always acting by himself. Founding is an individual activity, not the work of a committee. This fact allows Machiavelli to excuse the actions of Romulus, who famously murdered his brother Remus. We must assume, Machiavelli wrote, that it never or rarely happens that a republic or monarchy is well constituted or its institutions entirely reformed unless it is done by only one individual. It is even necessary that he whose mind has conceived such a constitution should be alone in carrying it into effect. Founding is an enormously difficult activity requiring an extraordinary degree of initial authority. Yet a founder often begins without holding an office of any kind. His authority eventually derives from taking advantage of what Machiavelli calls an opportunity, meaning a situation in which a people is faced with dire circumstances. These circumstances either already exist or the founder helps to create them. An opportunity is sometimes known today as a crisis, which is a terrible thing to waste. Opportunities create a situation in which people are disposed to follow. This spontaneous inclination only lasts so long, however, until things get difficult. People then grow discontented, and they wish to be rid of the founders, as when Moses faced rebellions in the desert from those who had willingly followed him out of the land of Egypt. At some point, Machiavelli observes, a founder will need to assure his authority by compelling obedience. As he says, things must be ordered in such a mode that when the people no longer believe, one can make them believe by force. Force consists of the use of physical arms or of psychological control, most often by manipulating religious beliefs to instill fear. Founding for Machiavelli takes place on different levels. It can refer to changing the frame of government inside of an existing state, or it can mean establishing an altogether new nation or political form, perhaps one that never existed before. Or it can mean transforming an entire culture or civilization from, say, changing things from the pagan era to the Christian era, or the Christian era to the Enlightenment era. Founding in this last case thus extends beyond politics in the usual sense of acting as one in that situation. It is a project that no single person can ever accomplish in a lifetime. Only a founder endowed with a religious message or an active set of theoretical ideas can hope to succeed in changing an entire culture. This thinker-actor induces others to carry out parts of the project, often without their realizing its origins. A type of invisible founder, deciding to become active, becomes, as it were, the real founder, exercising influence across generations or centuries, and bringing into being a new mode and order. The greatest examples of such type of founder would be Jesus, or perhaps Paul, who changed matters from the pagan to the Christian civilization, and Machiavelli himself, who founded the Enlightenment project that is slowly replaced an eroded Christianity. René Descartes, the thinker who inaugurated the Enlightenment project within the realm of philosophy, also offered an account of the lawgiver that extended Machiavelli's analysis. Early in the Discourse on Method, Descartes describes his ideal city planner, who's a kind of stand-in for a founder. Descartes wrote, "There's not so much perfection in works created by the hands of various masters as there is in those which one person has worked on alone. Thus we see that the buildings which a single architect has undertaken and completed are usually more beautiful and better ordered than those which several people have tried to refurbish by making use of old walls built for other purposes." Descartes then goes on to propose building a city in regular places which an engineer has designed freely on level ground. So Descartes' lawmaker is again, like Machiavelli's, a single person who tears everything down and begins de novo. Relying on a science likened to engineering, which supplies exact answers, the founder acts unconstrained by customs or by ancient structures. The scenes of violence that swept away old practices, in which Machiavelli so delighted, go unmentioned as the founder eliminates the past and builds the new city from scratch. Descartes presents the technocrat's dream of founding, operating with complete rational control, unimpeded by the wishes and views of the people. Finally, to mention someone who took up the theme of founding, there's Jean-Jacques Rousseau, who envisaged the lawmaker in the most extraordinary of terms. Rousseau depicts the founder once again as acting on his own, seeing further than all other men. Founders are responsible for establishing an entire new system, far surpassing the accomplishments of statesmen who only put into effect what the founder has already created. The founder should never try to govern, but limit his tasks to setting up the new system. He then disappears. Few possess the genius to perform this extraordinary function, which demands, quoting Rousseau, the ability to change human nature, so to speak, to transform each individual who on his own is a complete and solitary whole into part of a greater whole from which he, in a way, receives his life and his being. The founder's task exceeds in difficulty all what other political actors ever try to do. Executing a plan of founding for Rousseau must be fitted carefully to the needs of each place, which vary greatly. A general science of politics can only take one so far. Artistic or poetic insight is also required. The act of founding must generate an extraordinary authority that goes beyond what reason and argument could ever sway the people to do. A founder will always have to invoke divine sanction to accomplish this project. Well, so much for the ones who treated founders directly in the classical spirit. Now I want to say a word about British political thought, which was the background to American thought, and the denial of the idea of founding. A British political thought in the 17th and 18th centuries, in the form of two schools of thought known as contract theory and organic development, eliminated the founder. They may have done so with a deliberate strategy in mind of discouraging would-be Machiavellian leaders from unsettling the political world. Or they may have concluded that founding was an artifice or fiction, especially for modern times. Whichever the case, these schools broke from classical and parts of early modern thought and presented their political science without the presence of the figure of the lawmaker. Americans, as we'll see in a moment, relied greatly on British political thought in the late 18th century. But with Madison and the Federalists, they brought back the concept of founding. Now, contract theory, deriving largely from John Locke, held that governments formed by individuals voluntarily come together on the basis of reasoned calculation of how best to secure their primary rights, above all, a right to life or personal safety and a right to the preservation of property. The creation of a sound political order is assisted by a science of politics that, becoming known in a simplified form to the public, helps in the actualization of this process of founding. The science explains how people live in a state of nature, which is a situation without government, and would logically people would logically leave this to transition into civil government. This model might eventually be adopted everywhere in the world. Setting up a civil society has no need of a great founder endowed with an extraordinary authority. The origination of society is routinized and accomplished in a reasonable and semi-automatic process of creating a social contract. Contract theory is a replacement for the model of founding. Resting on the logic of reason and interest, it eliminates reliance on chance. Waiting for a great or heroic lawmaker to appear, which can never be guaranteed, is unnecessary. No longer is there a need for a single person of extraordinary political genius to act. If certain minimal conditions obtain, chiefly the elimination of priestly control and religious superstition, the establishment of a sound civil order should automatically follow. Now, the other school of British thought, maybe less known to some here, organic theory or Whig jurisprudential theory, that was the other school dominant in Britain at the time. It taught that the English Constitution had formed gradually over time as a product of accident and piecemeal adjustment. England, by this account, never had a single moment when it began. It had no founding and no founders. Its origins lay somewhere back when, whether in the famed forests of Germany among the Gothic tribes, or at some other time immemorial prior to the advent of clear records. England's magnificent constitution grew by trial and error. Human intelligence appeared along the way to produce what Edmund Burke called reform, but it introduced, and reform introduced adjustments and partial correction. But there was no such thing as a wholesale transformation or a beginning anew, such as Machiavelli and the ancients describe. Organic theory, and organic is the idea of growing, organic theory argued that a science of politics is unequal to the task of founding. The process is far too complex to be understood rationally. It is beyond what any human being, regardless of intelligence, can manage. In addition, the extraordinary authority needed to carry out the task of founding is a threat to liberty. Founding destroys restraint and collectivizes all power in the hands of the founder. It must be achieved also by force and fraud. The example of this kind of beginning will live on, and it will sanction later attempts to destroy free government. So proponents of the organic theory presented their account of English constitutional development as actual history. This assertion may reflect their best understanding, what they actually thought happened, but it may also represent a constructed narrative designed to conceal elements of the past and make people forget the enormity and radicalness of an event like the Glorious Revolution. The organic school seems to have been less concerned with perfect accuracy in history than with presenting, in the guise of history, the teaching of its political philosophy. Organic theory was meant to dampen the enthusiasm Machiavelli had created to make ambitious men think of clearing slates and beginning anew. Moderation was the organic theorist's watchword. To this end, organic theory eliminated founding. Burke explained that the British Constitution had not been formed, I quote, upon a regular plan or with any unity of design, but it instead grew in a great length of time and by a great variety of accidents. As if in opposition to Descartes, Burke was partial to the crooked and narrow streets of old, preferring them to either the homogeneity of engineered plans or the cultivation of egotistical genius of modern architects. As for celebrating founding, Burke expressed himself with notable directness. The very idea of the fabrication of a new government, he said, is enough to fill us with disgust and horror. Now the Americans. American political thought in the 18th century broke with both schools of British thought and brought the theme of founding back into political science. For all that Americans had borrowed from the English, this difference between them divided and still divides Britain and America. It separates their traditions of conservatism, with Americans celebrating a deliberate beginning and the British anchoring their constitutional system in custom and evolution. Americans accept the concept of founding, the British do not. The Federalist, America's most important work of political thought, disputes the claim of organic theory that political constitutions are the result of unplanned growth and accident. Its opening paragraph announces that the outcome to the debate over ratification, and now I'll quote from Federalist One, will determine whether societies of men are capable or not of establishing good government from reflection and choice, or whether they are forever destined to depend for their political constitutions on accident and force. That would be the organic theory. The Federalists obviously wagered on reflection and choice, positing that intentional founding is indeed a possibility. America's founders were certainly not wild-eyed idealists, eager to reject what was old and customary just because it was old and customary. But they made clear that, when necessary, they would follow a new course. The Constitution would mark a pivot point in world history. Madison reminded his readers what the revolutionary leaders had set in motion. Here's a nice sentence from Madison. "Happily for America, happily we trust for the whole human race. They pursued a new and more noble course. They accomplished a revolution which has no parallel in the annals of human history. They reared the fabrics of government which have no model on the face of the globe." The Federalists' embrace of the concept of founding returned the idea of greatness to the center of political life, and it silently restored a claim of rank and hierarchy between founders and people. There were now great men performing great deeds at critical moments. Everything hinged on these great men's deliberate action. The Federalist also presents a new kind of figure to admire, one who combines a knowledge of the science of politics, judgment in determining where the theoretical knowledge applies to existing circumstances, and persistence and boldness in pursuing the nation's interests. The authors of this work were subtly presenting a picture of themselves. The theme of founding culminates in James Madison's explicit introduction of the lawmaker in Federalist No. 38. Madison provided a list of 14 ancient reformers or lawgivers, examining cases in which governments has been established with deliberation and consent. Madison then proceeds to compare America's founders with those renowned figures of antiquity. He casts a glance at the future. If the Constitution was ratified, America's founders would become not just the worthy rivals of the ancients, but in light of what Madison thought were the improvements made by Americans on the ancient mode of preparing governments, they would become their superiors. The argument for the preeminence of America's founders is seen from how the task of founding was carried out. Beginning with the issue of the number of founders, Madison recalled that for the ancients, the task of framing had always been performed by some one individual citizen of preeminent wisdom and improved integrity, never by an assembly of men. In opting for a select body of persons at the convention, however, Americans entrusted the task of founding to a few persons. Madison conceded that this method risked creating discord and disunion, which in fact occurred more than a few times at the convention. But this method offered the prospect of achieving more wisdom through dialogue and a greater consensus in favor of the outcome. When it came to the question of how a plan was to be adopted, ancient practice ranged from the founders who tried to discern what the people would agree to and follow, which limited what they proposed, or seeking greater perfection, they would abandon consent and proceed by using force. Madison admitted having admiration for the founders of antiquity who used force, but this approach was impossible in America. The founders in 1787 lacked the means to compel. There was no national army under their control. All that was left to them was persuasion. Nor did the American founders appeal to unnatural forces working in their favor, unless one counts the providential fact of having George Washington on their side. Seeking consent in the ratification process brought an additional benefit. No gap or tension existed between the act of founding in America and the subsequent system of rule under the new Constitution. Both were based on Republican principles. Ratification became a legal means to create a social contract, setting a precedent for other modern republics. Note how this process contrasts with the methods followed within the European Union, where referenda by the publics of member states have been ignored in reversions and revisions of the European project. Madison's example of examination of ancient republics confirmed what he had learned at the convention. Founding, even under the most favorable circumstances, revealed, he said, the hazards and difficulty incident to such experiments and the great imprudence of unnecessarily multiplying them. This conclusion prepared Madison to take a new and decisive step. In the process of writing the Federalist, he undertook on his to act on his own, therefore acting in a sense like a classic founder, to set forth a new meaning to what exactly a written constitution should be. To avoid repeating the great difficulties of founding, he proposed that the Constitution should be regarded with two words he uses frequently, with veneration and with reverence, and not easily or frequently altered. With deepening support that comes with age, the Constitution would have the prejudices of the community on its side. The instrument of a written constitution, superior to statutory law and changeable only by a process separate from ordinary lawmaking, was an American innovation that developed in the States in the period just after the Revolution. Yet this fact never extended to the idea that a constitution should be thought of as an enduring symbol that would connect future generations to a founding period. Even today, a written constitution is not automatically associated with something that should be treated with great reverence or respect. In many of the states, for example, people have no such feelings, nor are they expected to. Constitutions in some states are easily amended, and many of them have been rewritten in full. It would take a person of peculiar temperament and perhaps questionable sanity to venerate the Constitution of California. Madison's idea of forging a connection between veneration and the Constitution deepened in early 1788. It emerged in response to the circulation of Thomas Jefferson's book, Notes on the State of Virginia, which proposed the idea of a very low threshold for revising written constitutions. It contained, in fact, a different idea of what a written constitution was. Jefferson regarded written constitutions more as ordinary law, superior, yes, in their legal status, but ordinary in the sense that, like statutory law, they should be regularly updated and improved. Jefferson, in fact, proposed elsewhere that every constitution would have to be written every generation. A reverence for the Constitution and for founders, he believed, imprisoned the public mind. It favored a disposition to accept past authority and fostered superstition. Jefferson mocked this kind of subservience, later famously writing, "Some men look at constitutions with sanctimonious reverence and deem them like the Ark of the Covenant, too sacred to be touched. They ascribe to the men of the preceding age a wisdom more than human and suppose what they did to be beyond amendment." In other words, revering founding moment. Like many progressives at the turn of the 20th century who followed Jefferson's sentiments and borrowed his language, placing founders on a pedestal and venerating their document should at all costs be rejected. The persons living today will possess greater political wisdom than those who lived in the past, and those living in the future will have greater wisdom than those living now. For Jefferson, laws and institutions must go hand in hand with the progress of the human mind. If there was a prevailing understanding of what a written constitution was in 1787, before Madison wrote, I believe that this probably was it. Madison offered a new and different view of a written constitution. No blind worshiper of his ancestors, Madison was, he nevertheless saw no reason to defy prudence and invite constant constitutional revisions. Better, he thought, to respect an achievement that was made, shield it from undue pressure of change, and protect it from future actions of those likely to possess far less political intelligence and prudence. Even more important, reverence for the Constitution affects how people think of the entire political world around them. It creates, to use a fancy term, a certain political epistemology. It encourages citizens to look to and to value the past, a past that in this instance, by good fortune, provided near as much as one could hope for. Without this disposition, it's hard to imagine that we would ever have had founders at all. Thank you.